Hey, are we live yet? Are we live yet? Testing. 1, 2, 3. Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's online podcast with your host, Jan Irvin. Here we investigate the religious, the mysterious, the entheogenic, the shamanic, and the Gnostic with the small g. Haven't heard it someplace else, you'll likely hear it here. So sit back and relax. Take a trip through time and a journey through your mind as we investigate the ancient mysteries.
Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast number 29. Wow, we're getting up there. Today we'll be discussing Amanita muscaria, the fly agaric mushroom. Why is Amanita so prevalent in folkloric, mythical, and religious iconography? Why do Amanita mushrooms seem less ergonomic than other entheogens? And if they are less ergonomic, could they have played as prevalent a role in ancient religions as modern scholars claim? Is there a special method or technique used to gain a fuller experience from the Amanita? My guest is Wolfgang Bauer, co-author and co-editor of Der Fliegenpilz, The Fly Mushroom, Dream Cults, March Magic, and Mythical Intoxication. Wolfgang Bauer is a German psychologist who has studied optical illusions by Professor Rausch at the J.W. Goethe University in Frankfurt, Maine, and is editor of Sergius Golowin's classic treatise on witch herbs and magic mushrooms, called Magie der Verbotenen Märchen from Hamburg, 1973, which became a cult book in the 1970s and which was secretly Xerox copied in the communistic eastern parts of Germany and distributed in the hippie underground there. Wolfgang Bauer is co-editor of Integration, the journal for mind, moving plants, and culture, editor and co-author of Der Fliegenpilz from 2000, and his collection of objects relating to the fly agaric has been exhibited by the Carl Ernst Osthaus Museum in Hagen and several times in museums throughout Europe. Upcoming shows: Alan Piper to discuss entheogen use in Zoroastrianism and Islam, and Dr. Neil Goldsmith on psychedelics and psycho-spiritual development, and G. Edward Griffin on The Creature from Jekyll Island, which is about the Federal Reserve being a big scam that's been put on the American population, and Professor Benny Shannon from Hebrew University of Jerusalem, Israel, will be coming on to discuss ayahuasca and his book Antipodes or Antipods of the Mind, however you like to pronounce that. And once again, the Spanish subtitle version of the Pharmacratic Inquisition DVD has been released on the pharmacraticinquisition.com website, so please be sure to check that out, or you can also get to that from the Gnostic Media website. There's a big link right in the top middle of the website. So check that out. Hope to get that Russian voiceover version online soon. We've also got Dutch and Portuguese now available. So hang on. Hopefully we'll get more versions available soon. And if you're listening to this show and you can translate to either Arabic or French, we would love to get your help on that. And I know the show is being downloaded in places like Kuwait and Iran and a few other places, so please volunteer to help if you wouldn't mind. I would appreciate it. And if anyone in the audience can help do transcriptions, we still need help getting the transcriptions done. We've had a number of people volunteer, and a few of them have gotten finished, but we still need more help, so if you can help with that. If you can't afford to donate or something, maybe that's something that you would like to do instead. So please contact me at contact@gnosticmedia.com. and the views expressed by the authors and guests of this program are their own and are not necessarily those held by Gnostic Media or myself. This show runs on donations. If you would like to support this programming, please go to www.gnosticmedia.com. That's G-N-O-S-T-I-C media.com and click on the donations button at the top left of the page. And this show is not corporate media. It is independent media in the truest sense of the words. And by supporting it, you help continue this programming. And we appreciate everyone's help. If you can only donate $5 or $10 or $50 or whatever you can donate, it's greatly appreciated. And thanks to everyone who has been donating. All of your donations are greatly appreciated. And if you'd also like to support this show by purchasing one of my books or DVDs, I've got Astrotheology and Shamanism available that I co-authored with Andrew Rutaji. You can get that in a color version or black and white. But the color edition is numbered and signed, and the color edition also comes with a free Pharmacratic Inquisition DVD. Or you can order just the DVD from the website, and you can also get a copy of my last book, The Holy Mushroom, Evidence of Mushrooms in Judeo-Christianity, available there as well. And I do sign each of the books before they go out. And so that's about it. If you would like to contact me directly, please contact me at contact@gnosticmedia.com. And enjoy my interview with Wolfgang Bauer. All right, Wolfgang, welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast number 29. How are you today?
Wonderful. Fine. We have sun outside. I feel great.
That's good. And I understand you've had some nasty weather the last few days there.
Yeah, much rain. And my child could not go out and eat because the weather was too bad. And that's not so good for her. She needs to eat very quick salad and herbs to get strong again, you know.
What happened?
She slept the whole winter, and now she is awake, and she can only be outside when it's a certain degree of warmth. Because she has no real blood. She is as a frog. If it's cold, she cannot move.
Oh, yeah.
You understand?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you want to talk a little bit about yourself and your background? And maybe your education so people can get to know who you are a little bit?
Uh-huh. In the main, I'm a psychotherapist for adults who have psychic problems or are not adapted to their work or do have stress or feel anxiety or even panic. When I'm doing supervision for social workers and teachers, I have done a lot of social research in youths and young adults, what they think about the world, how they feel, what is their plan for their life, and I'm a writer in the field of folklore and folk botany. That maybe in short gives some impression what I do.
And how did you get interested in studying psychology?
Yeah, you must understand, in Germany after the war, people were disillusioned. They did not have an idea what is the sense of life. They were partly traumatized by the war. Many young people had lost the father in the war, and that created a society which was full of problems. And I think I felt that too that time, because I was young after the war. And that made me look after psychology, to study psychology, to understand these things better, and to work with people.
And, well, you've... You've written a book called Der Flaggenpilz, and you've, from what I understand, you've also written a book on symbolism. Would you care to discuss your symbolism book?
Yeah, that was about 1980. We had the first influences from hippies of young and fresh ideas of the 68 people, and by the Nazis, many things had a bad stamp. If you did folklore or you talked about folkloristic problems, people said, oh God, maybe he is belonging to the old Nazi dictatorship. And what we did, we made a book which brought back to the people somehow old wisdom, old myths, old fairy tales. We gave them the chance to go into a subject which they had given up or had even lost. Our book on symbols was the first book after the war, and it became a success. I never forget when I visited Albert Hoffmann and he showed me his large room with books, and then we went to his working room and there were only 20 books. And he said, these are the books I need every day, and to my greatest pleasure, my Encyclopedia of Symbols was standing there. And I found that a real great moment. And he said, I know you have contributed to this beloved encyclopedia.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, what other books have you published or contributed to?
It's books on the cultural history of magic and magicians. That was my first book, was called Metamorphosis. I did a lot on the general subject of folklore, that is the conception of vampires, the conception of lycanthropy, that is werewolf, the werewolf in the night at the full moon. I have done a book on soothsayers, prophets, seers, and clairvoyants. It's not long ago, about 4 or 5 years back. Then I did a book on ancient forests, ancient forests in Europe. There are some relics of ancient forests still. One of it is the wonderful wood in France, in Brittany, Bretagne, you understand?
Yes.
And there is a little relic of the old wood of the magician Merlin. And there is a holy well. And this well was never Christianized or baptized. It's still a heathen well. And I also did a book with other authors on holy wells in general, and on healing wells. We in Germany have a lot of spas, and many of these spas go back to Celtic or Roman times. There are some spas where the well still was put into a wall by a Roman architect. And there is a lot of findings of heathen gods and goddesses, or of nymphs carved in stone. Always when they dig near such an old well, they find a lot of archaeological things, which are very interesting and mind-opening, I think.
Huh.
Also, I did...
Yeah. Go ahead.
Also, I did books on magic plants, on magic mushrooms in fairy tales, and naturally I had the chance to publish 2 times a book on the fly agaric in all his aspects.
Would you talk more about these wells that, you know, and the archaeological discoveries around the wells? That sounds like some fascinating stuff. You mentioned some of the things they might find there, but could you go into a little more detail about that?
Yeah, we had, as we had a Roman Besetzung, I put it another way. So Romans were here in Germany for a long time, for some centuries. They had put war on the people who lived here, which consisted mainly of Celtic tribes and German tribes, Germanic tribes, and they gave the population a sort of a mixed religion. So the old Celtic ideas could merge with Roman concepts of gods and goddesses, and there were really prospering holy places where you could go to get back your health, or you could go there and could ask for a favor of the nymph of this well, or you could you even could put a bad fluch. I don't know how to word for fluch. What is it? If you don't like somebody and you give him bad words, you could ask.
You cast a spell on them or witchcraft.
Right,
or sort of
right.
Thing.
You could ask the goddess of the well that she helps you to put a spell on somebody who has done something wrong against you. And there have been in Bath, in England, they have found about 200 of little tabloids where there is written the spell. So, that's after 2,000 years. I think that's absolutely fascinating. Or Dodona in Greece, you did have an old oak, and at the roots of the oak there was a well, and you could go there, and there was a priestess or a priest, and he heard to what the tree said with his leaves, and he then gave you an answer to your questions. A very fascinating thing. And what is left is that we have a lot of spas who have warm water, thermen, where you can lie down in the warm water, and it's still a long tradition for German people to visit such spas, let's say at the weekend, or you do a cure. Our friend Edward Klapp is in the moment in Bad Gastein and does a cure with drinking water, thermic water, and bathing in thermic water. And in most cases, people come back and are a little bit more well, have another consciousness, have got another consciousness because they have walked in old woods, they have sitting there, have heard music. It's a very old way to bring somebody back to himself.
How did all of this lead you into researching the fly agaric?
Yeah, that's a nice, an interesting and nice question, because when I was about 4 years old in the year 1944, I went with my mother into the nearby wood, and she wanted to get some fruit from wild hedges, and she was gathering because there was not much, because it was wartime. And suddenly we heard the dark voice of airplanes above us that were American and English bombers who flew very deep, and the pilots were bored because they did sit there for hours and hours after they finally could put out their bombs. And so they shot on anything which was down on the earth just out of boredom. And my mother said, quick, quick, let's go here in a fir wood to get protection. And we went there, and I saw a group of fly agarics, which fascinated me because they were so wonderful red with the white in it. And I ran to it, and my mother said, stop, stop, don't do that. This is a house where the dwarves live. Do you would like that a huge person, a giant, would come to our house and would walk on it? And I stopped and went back and let the fly agarics alone. But naturally, this event may have influenced me a lot later, that I was so interested in fairy tale books in which you could always see a fly agaric. Or when I did one of my first work as an editor for a book of Sergius Golovin. Sergius Golovin was a Swiss researcher on myths and fairy tales, very well-known man for the Swiss people. If you did write Sergius Golovin, Switzerland, he was so well known to everybody that he got that letter. And I had the chance to edit one of his first books on plant magic, on witches' herbs. And in that book, there was a small chapter on the fly agaric as a possible agent to get into visions and fantasies which could be fairy tale-like. And that fascinated me a lot, and I talked to Sergius, and he said, I only could give some ideas. There is really a big lot more in this mushroom. And he was right, because today I sit in a house full of items which are connected with the fly agaric, and I could do about 6 or 7 exhibitions on the fly agaric, and we even could fill the Royal Tropical Museum in Amsterdam with all that stuff. And I am now a sort of expert for the fly agaric in Europe. And I think these two events, the walk with my mother and the editing of this book of Sergius Golovin, led to all that interest.
So, in your opinion, why do you think the Amanita has become such an icon? I mean, a lot of people mention that ergonomically speaking, it's not as effective or reliable as other entheogens like psilocybe mushrooms and things like that. Why, in your opinion, do you think that the Amanita has become such an overwhelming icon in folklore and religion and things like that compared to some of these other substances?
I think that it is an old, ancient, let's say, holy plant, holy mushroom, which was mainly used by priests in Germany. It would have been Druids or the priests of the Germanic people. Later it would become the drug of wise men and wise women, of people who are who have knowledge of witches' arts, witches' science, which means they know how to change their consciousness to have entrance into other realms of our mind. I had a chance to talk with Timothy Leary once about that subject. He was in Germany for 3 weeks and I helped him around. And he always said there are many levels of consciousness, and with the one truck you can reach that level, with another truck you can reach another level. And as far as I know from many reports of people which I have interviewed, and of all I have heard from Clark Heinrich, from Sergius Golovin, from everybody who had done experiences with the fly agaric, I'm convinced that this wonderful mushroom looks for people himself. If he is not interested to open himself for somebody, he just gives him a vomit or a deep coma, and that was it. But if he is interested and he finds the right person, he gives him probably insights which we cannot even guess about. Maybe I should tell one of the experiments which Sergius Golovin had done. He, unaware of the number of mushroom heads, he was once invited by people who lived in the Swiss mountains, maybe a little hippie family, and the lady offered him mushrooms, caps dried in the sun. And he thought, being very young to that time, these 7 pieces are one mushroom cap only. And he ate them all because he wanted to be respectful to his host. And then he was away for 2 days, for a day and a whole night. And he lay just on the floor like a Siberian shaman. There are a lot of interesting illustrations from old times where you can see one shaman who watches, which is what Tim always said, look for a set and setting, have somebody near you who watches your travel into the other world. And then you have the picture of a shaman lying down and who apparently is in a very, very deep trance. And Sergius seemed to have such a trance also, seemed to have experienced such a deep trance. And when he awaked after 2 days, he said, whoa, I know every secret of the universe. I have been everywhere. I saw the world beginning. I saw it collapsing and beginning again. I even met God. I have met every being which is in the universe. And then his wife said, okay, and what is the secret of the universe? And Sergius said, oh, I see I have already forgotten it. But I know that I knew it.
That's, you see? Yeah. Who was this?
Sergius Golovin, a Swiss folklorist, and he has written 60 books about myths and about fairy tales and about folklore. And he was he unfortunately died 2006. He stemmed from a Russian noble family. The Golovins have always accompanied the Russian Tsar with people who had worked in the government or were artists. And Sergius' father had to flee from the communists in 1930, and so the father fled to the Switzerland, and there it was that Sergius grew up, and he combined in a really fine way folklore which was given to him from Russia with other European traditions. So he was an excellent analyst of all that stuff.
Huh. So let me ask you this. Have you tried the Amanita muscaria yourself?
Yes, but always in a good setting. I never did want to make it just a party drug.
Yes,
I
of course.
I always was interested to do an experiment. And I can tell you that even if you go into a wood in September, October, and you go to a group of Amanita muscaria, which are in an old stage, that means they look like a cup, and they can, when it has rained, they can contain water in it. And if this water had been there for some hours and you drink it, then you have the famous, what in fairy tales is called dwarf wine, the wine of the dwarfs. Even Tolkien, in his wonderful book, has a scene where the elves give dwarf wine to Frodo to bring back strength, power, and intelligence to him. And even Tolkien writes that this wine was golden, that it was liquid which had a golden color. And if you go into a wood and find such a cup of Zwergenwein, of dwarf wine, you will see that it is golden. And if you take some fly agarics and press them with a towel, and you will arrive to find and to have real golden liquid. You will have the aurum potabile, which is talked about by the alchemists, because I think they were great jokers. They loved to give us a riddle. And if you read some of their stuff and you put in the fly agaric, you can speculate that the famous stone of the wise may have been eventually also the fly agaric.
So, in your opinion, the Amanita in our culture, what it seems to me is that a lot of people don't use it properly or take the time to learn how to use it. They're looking for a very quick, they want something immediate like LSD or like psilocybin, where they take it once and then they think that they know all about it. And whereas Amanita, you're saying it sort of selects you, or that you have to learn how to use it and become familiar with it.
Yeah, you need probably years. You will need years. You cannot take it, throw it in, and because I have the feeling the mushroom is a good fighter, because he really can send you to the toilet for hours, or he can strike you with dampness and you will sleep. And you will wake up and will say, "Oh God, my head is nearly lost. I feel headache. Why did I idiot take this terrible mushroom?" And many people will say, "Forget it." And I think that's okay, because it's not a drug or a dust. Throw it in.
Right.
Leave it to Indian medicine men, leave it to the Siberian tribes, let's have some artists. I talked with Stanley Kittner once, and he told me that he had found, after a long research, he found two artists who had taken the fly agaric and were quite happy. And all the other artists had taken some stuff which gave a quick a vision or a quick result. If you understand what I mean.
I think so. If you could, that last sentence I wasn't too sure about. A quick what?
A quick result.
Oh, I see.
Many
okay.
people, what you told before, they want LSD or want something other stuff which quickly produce an effect. And in most cases, people do not know, and that maybe is a very, very, very important aspect of the fly agaric too, that the fly agaric, but also the psilocybin mushrooms and other psychoactive plants are mainly mean to visit the other world and the inhabitants of this other world. They can show you your own inner landscape, what people call psychonauting or a psychonaut. But I think that is only a side effect. The main thing is that people who, like today is in Germany, Walpurgisnacht, I don't know if this is an English expression.
Not that I'm familiar with.
It's the night before the 1st of May, and in all Europe, this is the night of the witches. This is the night where women take their broom in as a picture and fly to our famous devil's mountain, the Brocken. The Brocken is where Goethe has sent Faust and Mephistopheles to get wisdom in talking with the devil and with the witches. And this is a very nice coincidence. This day, this evening, this night is Walpurgisnacht. It's a night of the witches, and it's a sort of evening where children change clothes as little witches and run through the streets and make nonsense. And this night on the Brocken, this is one of the big mountains in Germany, about 2,000 meters high, there will be about 20,000 young people who celebrate this night of the witches with fires, with music, with chanting, and maybe two or three of them even may have eaten fly agaric. I don't know. But what I want to say is that is important, that at days like Walpurgisnacht, or at the time of Halloween, or at the time of Christmas, certain people who did have an education in changing their consciousness, they had the chance to move on the other side, to move into the world which is, as we put it, which is next to this real world. And it's, let's say, it's a human right to see the other side of, to see the world which is not visible, because it's our system which has taught us, boy or girl, look around. Only what you can see here is real. And that is not what our ancestors did think. The Celts, the Romans, the Greeks, all the members of a tribe which may still exist in Africa or in Siberia or in South America, they think that the visible world is only one little part, a very, very little part of the huge whole world, which consists of things and of worlds which are not visible with our normal eyes. We need, in Germany you would say, we need Märchenaugen. Märchenaugen is, you need the eyes of a hero in a fairy tale. You need fairy tale eyes to see all that which you cannot see in a normal state of consciousness.
Why do you... Are you familiar with the work of Terence McKenna?
Yeah, I will never forget him, and I am deeply sad that he has gone so early. He once was in Frankfurt, and I had a chance to talk with him, and I was deeply, deeply impressed.
Why do you think that he was so against the Amanita muscaria? You know, he tried it twice. Once he ate it raw and got sick and threw up, and another time he says that he ate it like a plate-sized mushroom, but he never believed that it was a true entheogen or that it could take you to these worlds. Why do you suppose that was?
Yeah, I have other experiences. He was here in Frankfurt and did a two-day workshop on the Amanita muscaria. And that was one of these occasions where he ate one raw, and faith did not like to make him happy with it. But one has to know that the Amanita is a sorcerer himself. The mushroom grows at some parts and is not laden with anything. It's just zero. It's just red fly agaric, but it has no substances in it. We have a great German pharma firm, the firma Maddaus. They collect still fly agarics in autumn. And they know that mushrooms, fly agarics, which are laden, where there is what they look for to put it into a medicine. These mushrooms are beginning in South Germany, where there is more sun, where there are many hills. And it is said by this firm that the best mushrooms grow on mountains. And when Terence McKenna was here in Frankfurt, Frankfurt is nearly, let's say, 100 meters above ground zero. And so he may have got a mushroom which had nothing in it. And the mushroom choked our friend Terence. And the other theory could be that other drugs wanted to speak out of Terence McKenna. And you know his absolutely professional performances, which are recorded on CD. One cannot believe how he talks. He is a poet. He is an absolute artist. When a spirit is in him and speaks out of him, and out of him there speaks his beloved psilocybin mushroom. And all the other stuff which he tried out in South America. Do you know Eduardo Luna?
I've heard of him. He's written some artwork on ayahuasca. Is that correct?
Right. When he was a very young man, he found in the jungle, in Pucallpa, he found in a coffee shop, he found Terence McKenna with his brother, and they were just young students, and they had come to the Amazon jungle to do research on psychoactive plants, and by accident they found this young Eduardo Luna. When he was a student and his father was a doctor, and so he took him home to his father, and quickly they understood what they want, and they found a shaman from an Indian tribe, and so Terence McKenna and his father were very, very happy and got a very good start in researching all that stuff. But they were more interested in I think in drugs and not so much in the fly agaric.
Right.
I hope this gives some ideas.
So basically, in your opinion, though, you think that in this case, Terence was wrong about the Amanita muscaria and its abilities, correct?
Yeah, we could say in one word, in one sentence, he did not have the luck to be happy with it. The spirit of the fly agaric and his fascinating personality did not match.
That's a good way to put it. Their personalities didn't match.
Yes. I think I never would match with the spirit of Hanbane or Datura or something like that. I'm not a night shadow person, you understand?
Right. Interesting. Could you talk about the book or the two different versions of the book that you co-authored or co-edited with Alexander Rosenbaum and Edzard Klapp?
Yeah. The whole thing started when
That's called Der Fliegen Pills, for those of you who don't know the name of the book.
Yeah, Der Fliegen Pills als Objekt eines Museums, the Fly Agaric as subject of a museum, was the first book, and after that we had the luck to find a publisher who gave a lot of colored photos in it and made a wonderful book out of it. And the whole thing started when a good friend, a Dutch artist and botanist, Herman de Vries, I'm not sure if you know him, he in the meantime has worldwide fame, and he was the founder and editor of this wonderful little journal of mind-moving plants and psychedelic culture. There were six journals of it. And he had the luck to have an exhibition of 200 plants from North Africa, from Senegal, and from India, which had healing properties or psychoactive properties. And he did that in the Karl Ernst Osthaus Museum in Hagen, in Germany, which is a very high-ranked museum for, especially for art. But the director to that time, Dr. Fair, liked the idea to say, I am more near to art when I exhibit plants as if I exhibit a picture which in some cases has been made out of color which have been a plant before. So he was a little bit of it was a revolutionary idea, and that was a great success. And after the exhibition, he said to me, I would very much like to make an exhibition only on one plant. Wolfgang, do you have an idea what sort of plant this could be? And naturally I said, oh, it only can be the fly agaric. For to that time I did have a full house full of items of the fly agaric, and Dr. Fair came, looked at it, was fascinated, and made a wonderful exhibition in his museum. And by that it happened that the first fly agaric book did appear in German language. And 10 years later, there were other museums who liked the idea to exhibit the fly agaric items, or one can put it, the exhibitions showed the cultural history of the fly agaric in all its aspects, which could be art, This could be alchemy, it could be fairy tales, it could be the use of the fly agaric as an agent in literature. There is a wonderful story from H.G. Wells about a sad husband of a wife who did have her lover in the house, and he had made the husband being some sort of slave who had to be a waiter for his wife and her lover. And so one day he is so much sad and depressed that he wants to kill himself, and he goes into a nearby wood, and he has a remembrance. There are red mushrooms. They kill you quick. You eat them and you are dead. And that is what then your wife maybe will show some emotion and will know what she has done. And so he goes into the wood, eats two handful of red capped mushrooms, and expects to die soon. But instead, he suddenly feels waves of angriness in him, and he goes back into the house, takes the lover, throws him out of the door, says to his wife, immediately I want to have something to eat and to drink and to have a good beer, and from this day on, I say where our money goes, and so on and so on. And Wells wonderfully shows how out of this man looks a little Berserk. Berserk is understandable?
Berserk? Perfect, or what's the word?
Berserk, Berserk. A man who goes Berserk.
Oh, berserk. We say berserk.
Berserk, yes, yes.
Yes, yes, okay.
Yeah. And so the fly agaric has given him all happiness.
That's a...
In the story 1899, written by H.G. Wells. It's unbelievable. And Wells was working as a pharmaceutical chemist, and that's why in all or many of his stories there appears a powder with magic qualities, there appears a herb with magic qualities, there is a mushroom with magic qualities. Wells was well informed about, I think, about all psychoactive substances which were available in the year 1899.
Would you talk about your co-author, Edzard Clapp? What can you tell us about him?
Yeah, Edzard was, as long as he worked, he was, what is it called, a public prosecutor? Public prosecutor, yeah?
Right, I believe that's what he told me.
Yeah, and one day he went in a bookshop and wanted to buy a cookbook on the art to prepare mushrooms, and he wanted to give it to his wife for her birthday. And then he asked for cookbooks on mushrooms. The bookkeeper or the employee in the bookshop said, go there, you find there a book from a certain Mr. Allegro. And that was the first contact of Edzard with the book from John Marco Allegro, The Mushroom and the Grass.
He took it home and was totally
fascinated. And then he read in a newspaper that I was engaged to gather material for a book on the fly agaric, and he gave me a call and we met, and that was how we came together and developed many things and research.
Would you?
He has done a wonderful job.
Yeah, you know, and he's over the last year, he has spent a tremendous amount of time. I would assume it took him a tremendous amount of time translating his and some of your German works into English so that I could read it. Yeah. And I've been slowly going through and organizing all of this stuff. And you two have some fascinating work there.
Yeah, I think so, too. And I think that Gyula Golovin was right when he said there is much, much more in the fly agaric as you can imagine, Wolfgang. And he was really right, because even today I still develop things or connections or associations which are new to me. For instance, some time ago, a father brought me a piece in which a young one can urinate.
Right.
I don't have the word for it in English.
Yeah, urinate is the proper word for...
It's a proper word. And this consisted of a jar, a cup, thing similar to a cup, and on that were, as a cap, a fly agaric, a hat of a fly agaric, and you could open the fly agaric hat, and the child could urinate.
Oh, that would be, you know, I have a 2.5-year-old, and that would be great.
That would be great. And you know that people say, and probably it's correct, that the fly agaric has a second appearance in the urine of somebody who had consumed the fly agaric.
Right, right. And you know, just real quick, what we've discovered recently that I put out on Professor Thomas Roberts' email list was that it's not just the Amanita that can be recycled. It's also psilocybin and peyote, mescaline, things like that as well. So it adds more to the story that way, but go ahead.
Because you must see there is a supplier for children's stuff and children's products, and unconsciously he does a piece, he does a product which has an association to the use of the fly agaric in Siberia. And he probably does not know. Somebody in him says, do such a thing and sell it. And so I think the fly agaric is a very nice joker, because he is in anything if you go in a shop, you always find an item which is connected with the fly agaric. You can have things like to put salt in it or to put pepper in it.
Right.
You can glasses in which is alcohol, and it's the whole thing represents a fly agaric, so you can drink it. You can have fly agarics out of chocolate, and you can eat it. I mean, it's a little bit what one can think about. How does that wonderful mushroom get represented? And you can even buy a dwarf, which has a red cap and which is set in, if you ask a child, please paint me a dwarf. And in many cases, this child will paint a dwarf with a red cap, and beside the dwarf, he or she will paint a fly agaric, and he will say, this is a house of fly agaric, and you can get dwarfs who smoke sitting on a sitting on a fly agar rig. And one thing you should know, and it's unbelievable, in Germany, you have 18 million dwarfs out of clay, which sit in gardens, which sit in flats, which are on playing grounds for children, and 18 million, and each year there are about 500 new dwarfs, and often together with a fly agar rig on which they sit, in which they live, or on which they play a game, a card play, and they are still sold. And if you want to make a symbol for German people, you could just show a dwarf with a red cap.
Yeah, you know, those those little statues are very common in the United States as well, with the dwarf sitting on the mushroom, and you know, I've seen the salt and pepper shakers, and I've seen that sort of stuff here as well. You mentioned John Allegro earlier. Would you talk about your interactions with him?
Yeah. When Edzard Klapp had found all that interesting information of John Marco in this book, we discussed all that on telephone, and when I planned to do a book on the several aspects, on the many aspects of the fly agar rig, I said we should give John Marco the honor to have him represented in that book. Let's ask him if he is willing to give us a summary of what he has written in his main book, The Mushroom and the Cross. And so we contacted him, and we found him a beautifully modest man on the one hand, but we found that he was a very, very intelligent man with a huge background of academic knowledge. And he was full of humor, and he even had only a laugh for all these terrible people who tried to bring him down, and who lied, and who told terrible stories about his drug abuse, which never was. He even did not drink, as far as I know. He did not even drink a beer or anything else.
Yeah, that's his daughter and I. We've looked into that, and we've not been able to find that he ever even had one drink in his whole life.
No. And he was a Marine. He was an officer during the World War. There were many opportunities where he probably had was asked to have a drink, but he just didn't want to have alcohol or something else. And so all that stories are. This is not very nice to put somebody down because you yourself are not able to understand him. Because what John Marco told us was that all over the world his wonderful book was sold in most cases without the large scientific apparatus which was at the end of the book. In
right.
Germany, they only published the first chapters, but not the scientific part.
Not the end notes, which the end notes were about 150 or 160 pages, which was almost half of the book.
And every journalist and everybody else thought he can laugh about that man and never had read his scientific evidence.
Right. Well, what do you think about, you know, you say that he was a very happy, easygoing guy. That flies in the face of what Gordon Wasson and Jonathan Ott have claimed about him.
It lies not in the...
It flies in the face. It goes against... It directly goes against what Gordon Wasson and Jonathan Ott said about Allegro.
Yeah, he himself seemed not to have a source which was liable, and probably he did not like to call. He could have called him, or he could have sent a letter, or he could say, let's meet, because Wasson had money enough, and I think John Marco was not bad off. He never gave the feeling that he is poor or so, you know.
Well, yes, and Wasson had sent him one letter, sort of in a way asking Allegro to meet him, but at the same time, what Wasson did was 2 days later, he sent a letter of September 16th, I believe, 1970, sent a letter to the Times Literary Supplement and the editor there, Crook, and basically countered everything he said in the personal letter to Allegro, and then attacked him publicly and made up all of these lies about him. And then when Allegro didn't bother to respond to him after he published that horrible letter in the Times Literary Supplement, then Wasson used that lack of response as his excuse to attack Allegro further.
Yeah, no, that was probably not so gentlemanlike, as we say in German.
Yeah, well, one of these days, I don't know if you have a copy of my book, The Holy Mushroom, but I analyzed this.
Not now. I am trying to get it.
Okay, well,
I must ask Edzard how I can get it.
Okay, well, we'll talk about that after the show here.
Yeah. Okay.
Let me ask you, and sorry for interrupting you there, but let me ask you about Little Red Riding Hood.
Yeah. Yeah, this was one of the things where Sergius Golovin had done a little research, and Edzard and me, we looked through all these wonderful fairy tales which have a plot where something is changing, where something unnatural, something supernatural is happening. And we found out that in those fairy tales in which something is eaten or somebody drinks something, that then the magical change happens. When the wolf, let's say, who is a wolf? Is he a young man who is doing an initial rite? Was he sent into the wood to meet an old woman, and she advised him to eat a red-capped thing, which we call Rotkäppchen or Red Riding Hood? And then he eats it, and later his belly opens, and Red Riding Hood comes out again. Then it is just what happens with a greedy user of the fly agaric, who takes Little Red Riding Hood, puts it in his mouth, eats it, and after some time he will vomit, and Red Riding Hood will be back again. That's one idea. Because in Germany, Red Riding Hood is Rotkäppchen, which means red cap, and red cap is one of the old names of the fly agaric.
Right. So that's actually the name in German is Little Red Cap, and the English name is Little Red Riding Hood.
Yeah. Yeah. Little Red Riding Hood is not so near to the German, to the original German text. Which is much more interesting is that since the 19th century, nearly all illustrators and people who have illustrated fairy tales, they say to the reader, look here, I, the illustrator, I am more clever than you think. I show you what makes the change. And so you can see Red Riding Hood, who does look for flowers, but if you look at the illustration, you see that Red Riding Hood is near a group of fly agarics, or you see the wolf who looks at the fly agarics with much more attention and foam in his mouth than that he would look on the little girl. So the illustrators give a hint. They say, look, when something happens which is so fantastic, you may not think that the people who have told the story are crazy. They just had some experience with a psychoactive mushroom, for instance. Or if you want, we can have a look to Snow White. Snow White gets a poisoned apple, which in Germany often is a red and white thing. On the one side it can be white, on the other side it can be red. We have made photographs where we have in one hand a cap of a fly agaric, in the other hand of an apple. And
yes.
If you photograph that and show that to two people, they are not able to say which is the fly agaric.
I have a picture of that actually in my first book that I did with Andrew Rutaji, and I just put out a color edition of that about 2 months ago, and in the color edition you can really, really see that.
See that? Oh, yes, okay. So, and this poisoned apple gives this Snow White girl just a sort of coma. She is coma stricken. She lies down in a coffin, and the dwarfs sit around her, and it needs a long time until she awakes, and that is what is normal for a travel with the a shamanistic travel with the fly agaric. I think we had that topic at the beginning of the interview. I told about the Siberian shamans who fall down and lay down for a longer period of time.
Right.
And in during that time, their soul goes out of the body and visits beings of other worlds and visits other worlds, goes to the underworld, goes to the world of the gods, and so on and so on. And there are more fairy tales. For example, I don't know if you know the fairy tale, which is also very famous, Brother and Sister. Sister and brother go into a wood.
Is that is that the story of Hansel and Gretel, or no?
No. It's brother and sister have to flee into a wood because a witch is behind them. And after a while, brother gets thirsty and wants to drink something, and they go to a well, and this well says, if you drink me, you will change into a tiger. And then sister says, oh God, if you are a tiger, you will eat me. So father says, okay, let's go to another well. And the other well says, if you go to drink me, you will become a wolf. And sister says, no, again, probably you eat me. And so they go to a third well, and this well says, if you drink from me, you will become a roebuck, a deer. Is understandable?
Deer, yes, yes, roebuck. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. And so, because he is so thirsty, he drinks of it. And when we look at the illustrations which accompany this fairy tale, you will find that there is no well. The painter just paints brother and sister before, and on their side there grows a fly agaric, or a group of fly agarics. And on the next picture, you see the sister who has her brother in her arms, who is a roebuck, who has changed magically into an animal. And then there is no a fly agaric anymore, because the brother has eaten the fly agaric and has changed in a shamanistic way into an animal.
Right.
Then you take Hänsel and Gretel, and you know that they go to the house of the witch, and they there eat bread which is outside of the hut, and after they have eaten it, then they see an old witch, and then it says in the fairy tale they felt like being in heaven, and that really can be one of the effects of the fly agaric or of other psychoactive mushrooms. And in old times, many people did hang mushrooms outside of their house to get them dried in the sun. And all that I know is that if you dry fly agaric in the sun, it, a chemist would know why, it's more loaded with the speciality which the mushroom can produce.
With muscimol, the decarboxylation of the ibotenic acid.
Okay. that's not my field.
This seems like a great segue to go into the Raven's Bread, since we were just talking about the bread of Hänsel and Gretel.
Yeah.
Would you mind going into the story about the Raven's Bread, and what can you say about the Shutul Valley in Afghanistan?
Yeah. So first, it was research of Edzard Glapp. He did find pictures of holy men who lived in the desert as hermits, and there are pictures where you see a raven who brings them heavenly bread, which is also called Rabenbrot or Raven's Bread. And in one of these pictures, the painter again has arranged this raven spread that you can see if you want a mushroom. And so Edzard Glapp did write a nice article speculating on this connection.
Let me ask you a quick question. Are you familiar with Alan? Yeah. Are you familiar with Alan Piper's work?
No, not yet.
Okay, I believe I sent you an email, both you and Edzard, I forwarded you an email that also has Alan Piper's contact in there, but I'm going to have him on the show next week, and he actually will be discussing some of the Amanita use in Afghanistan and this this same story, and he's done some follow-up research on that and on Zoroastrianism and things like that, and has some fascinating stuff, so... your and his interviews will be a wonderful a sort of package together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is just what I wanted to continue. On the other hand, an old friend of Edzard and me, Hartmut Gerken, who was the head of the Goethe Institute in Kabul, and the head of the Goethe Institute in Egypt, he did research on the use of Amanita muscaria in Afghanistan. And his first article led to all these speculations on the Shutul Valley and on the ritual or normal use of fly agaric. And in the Arabic language, if you translate the Arabic name, you find also that it says Rabenbrot, and the same is the case with the words in Afghanistan. And Hartmut found that people use it just as a beverage to make them nice dreams. One man tells a nice story. In winter time, there is nothing to do. I do make me a beverage with the fly agaric, and then I have dreams. I hear people talk to me, and in many cases, I can laugh about what they say. I think it's great. And on the other hand, they use the fly agaric as a medium, as a cure against frostbite and against a psychosis. If they have hallucinatory states, they use the fly agaric as antidote. And that's fascinating because in Germany we have a branch of medicine which is called homeopathy. Homeopathy.
Yeah, homeopathy. Correct.
Homeopathy. And you have that too.
Yeah. Yes. The same word.
And these people use the fly agaric as tincture is you take alcohol, put
right.
fly agaric in it, and afterwards you after some days you fill it in little bottles, and this is sold in a normal chemist shop in Germany, and it does the same thing. It helps against frostbites. It helps if people are in an aesthetic way of consciousness and do not come out, if they have what the doctor calls psychosis. And but they also have found out that people who took it for some days did have nice dreams of flying in the other world. So that's a wonderful circle, I think.
Let me ask you, tell me about the holidays and the fly agaric in Germany.
Yeah, I'm not sure. What is it exactly? All holidays. What time is it?
What role does the fly agaric play in holidays there in Germany, and what holidays? Why don't you talk about that?
Yeah, you mean a festivity or?
Yes, the festivities like Christmas or Easter.
Yes, now I understand. Yeah, if you would take a wheel of the year, there is always deep connection between the fly agaric as symbol or as to ornate certain things. For instance, if we begin with the day to day, with the Walpurgis night, the night of the witches, children wear clothes of a witch, and they have little mushrooms in their back, made of plastic, and they play with it, and they imagine to brew some magical potion with which one can fly or can do a hex or some magical operation. And if you go to Eastern some weeks back, you always have in Germany pictures where you see a hare, the figure which brings the axe in folklore. Hare,
right.
Is understandable.
Yes.
Animal with long ears.
Yes. Yeah. We use the same word. Hare or rabbit are the two words in English.
Uh-huh,
go ahead.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay. It's a hare, and this hare lives in a fly agaric, and this hare has dwarfs around him who paint the axe for the hare, which he will carry to the children. And you have, you would say, how can that happen? But in old law, there is a connection between dwarfs and hares, because people said a dwarf, when he wants to go around and he does not want that you know that he is a dwarf, he can change into a hare. And so if you see a hare, you can always be sure that could be a dwarf which has changed himself into an animal, so that he cannot be known or cannot be found out that he is a magical being doing a little travel. So that's, but on the other hand, if you look for young fly agarics, they are in the first stadium of their development. They are just little white eggs. And
yes.
If a rain is falling, the velum, the skin, goes away, and you will see five or six little red eggs. And red eggs are, in European tradition, they stay for love, for luck, for fruitful days, for children, for anything which makes gives fun to people. And so, if you want, you can find a good explanation why the hare is carrying colored eggs, especially red eggs, which are in many cases are very beloved. Children like everything which is red. And if you go on to the to Pfingsten, Pfingsten is a festivity where the Holy Ghost went into the apostles and they suddenly spoke in all languages. You probably have that in America too, this festivity.
Right.
It's in June or May. And to that time, every shop sells a ladybug. And a ladybug in Germany is also a sign of good luck. And the ladybug in nature has black points on his back.
Right.
But the people who sell this chocolate ladybugs, they put white spots on his back. So they give a connection to the fly agaric. And if you go to Halloween, it's very normal that you can, in Germany now we have real Halloween rage. 10 years ago, nobody did even know the word Halloween, but now young people like to do changing into witches and devil, or as Mr. Death. But some change just into a fly agaric. They have a fly agaric costume. And if you go further on to Christmas, most people do not know that to put a fly agaric out of plastic or out of another material to their Christmas tree, that is a very normal thing, because at the feet of a fir tree, there is a young child, there is the fly agaric, because the fly agaric needs the roots of the fir tree and the roots of the pine tree and the roots of the birch tree to develop. No fly agaric can exist without a tree, and especially in Germany is full with fir trees, and the fir tree is the Christmas tree. And
yeah, it's called mycorrhizal symbiosis is what you're talking about with the Amanita and the trees.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. You can speak this difficult word. I spared it because it's so difficult to say it. Yes, but nobody knows, only you, me, some botanists know. But nevertheless, the whole population thinks it's normal and correct to put fly agarics to the Christmas tree. And we have in East Germany, there is a factory which produces such fly agarics out of glass since the 19th century.
Well, you know, since I was a young child, my grandmother, every just before Christmas every year, which she would give me some of these, she would give me Christmas ornaments every year before Christmas. And when I first discovered this about the Christmas trees, oh, probably 10 years ago, I went to my Christmas ornament collection that I had been saving since I was about 3 years old, and I went through that and I found more than a dozen of these glass mushrooms in the collection.
Oh, great, great, yeah. Yeah. So, here we are.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, let me ask you what you feel is the most important aspect of your work.
I think on the one hand to have given a great variety of aspects in which you can find the fly agaric as an agent which gives us myths, which gives us fairy tale-like experiences, which tells us, do not forget the invisible world. Don't be only on the materialistic side of this world. Try to be at least in two worlds. Accept that it's not so easy. There will be reasons why you are not allowed to look into the invisible world just by daily use. You have to do something. You have to learn a certain you need a certain training, and the fly agaric is one of the oldest friends which the family of man does possess. I talked with a very famous lady who did write a lot of books on ethnic science, and she said probably the fly agaric is the oldest friend of mankind which exists, and this mushroom has given people ideas, has given them to develop their fantasy. This mushroom has done a lot for the development of human beings. And you know that when people have such experiences where suddenly they have the feeling that all living and not living things are connected to one another, gives many people the first time in their life the feeling that they are not so alone, that they are not living an empty life, that there is very, very much around them which gives them help, which has the same form of being together. Even if people may say there are little spirits in nature which are everywhere. I am never alone. I never walk alone.
Very fascinating information. I'm sitting there.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Well, I guess unless there's anything else that you would like to add to the interview, I think that about wraps things up. Is there, other than what you just said that was amazing in and of itself, is there any single idea that you would like people to especially remember from this interview?
Well, I would say, and I would like to repeat that on and on, please do not see the fly agaric as a recreational drug, as a drug for all-day use, but show respect, try to be respectful against this wonderful mushroom, and do anything that this wonderful mushroom can still be with us. For if there are no trees, if there are no fir trees, if there is no birch tree, if there is no pine anymore, there will be no fly agaric anymore. And we really may consist then of soaps which are produced in television. And that's all what is happening. There is no chance to leave our planet anymore, because what I was told by many people who do shamanistic techniques, they say the fly agaric is the only spaceship is the only spaceship which flies much more quicker than the velocity of light. Velocity of light.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. With the fly agaric, you can fly to any part of the universe. You can change into any time you want. You can talk to unbelievable beings outside of our Earth, and you are connected with the whole world from the beginning to its end and to its new beginning again. And I think that would be very sad if people are left back on an Earth which has no plants.
That sounds like the flight of the Phoenix.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, I understand. Yeah, that's a nice association. Yeah, yeah.
That just occurred to me as you were saying it. And This concludes Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast 29. I've been interviewing Wolfgang Bauer, the co-author of Der Fliegenpilz or Der Fliegenpilz. And Wolfgang, thank you so much for the wonderful interview. And I look forward to your future works. I know that you and Edzard are currently working on a new project now. And I hope to keep in touch with you, and I hope that we can get your future work in English so that we can keep abreast of your research.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. It was a great pleasure for me to talk with you.